I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome back to Radio Times. From the mid-19th century to the late 1920s, it's estimated that 200,000 homeless and orphaned children on the East Coast were put on trains to the Midwest to live and work with farm families. Life was hard, and there were few social services at the time. Our guest, Christina Baker Klein, interviewed a number of these grown-up children for her novel, Orphan Train. It's about a young girl from Ireland named Niamh who loses her family and is put on a train with other children headed for the Midwest. She has to fend for herself as she is moved from family to family. Her name is changed, and she settles eventually in Maine, where she lives in a big house alone and is known as Vivian Daly. The book is also about a teenager named Molly Eyre, who is aging out of the foster care system. They meet when Molly is doing community service, cleaning out Vivian's attic. Orphan Train was chosen by the Free Library of Philadelphia for their One Book, One Philadelphia selection this year. And Christina Baker Klein joins us on Radio Times from the NPR studios in New York City. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
So happy to be here.
Tell us about your personal connection to the story, because you learned that you had some family members that were orphans on this orphan train.
Right. I stumbled onto this story because I was visiting my in-laws in Fargo, North Dakota, of all places, in the middle of winter in a snowstorm with my children, holidays. And after several days, my mother-in-law, in desperation, pulled out a dusty book that she'd actually never looked at, which was filled with newspaper articles about her hometown, where she'd grown up, in Jamestown, North Dakota, tiny little place. Her father was president of the local savings and loan, and he was a sort of quiet, taciturn, stern man who never spoke about his past. But so she had received this book in the mail and never really looked through it. But in desperation, as I say, with my three boys running around, she corralled them and opened the book and started leafing through it. And they came across an article called it Orphan Train, and it proved there was a home for many children on the prairie. And my mother-in-law, as I mentioned, had grown up in this town until the age of 18, and apparently dozens, if not hundreds, of children from the orphan trains had ended up in that town, and yet she had never heard of it. Even more astounding, her father and his siblings were featured in this article with their photographs. So this was a huge shock to her. They were all dead at that point. She couldn't ask anyone about it. But it was astounding to all of us. My husband was a history major, you know, at Yale. You would think maybe he might have heard something about it in his history classes even, much less in his own family history. So it sent me on this journey. For a long time, I didn't feel that I was qualified to write the book because it wasn't my own family history. And most of the people who'd written about the orphan trains had been related to train riders or historians. But finally, I had amassed enough information and I'd learned enough about it that I realized I was ready to start. And by the way, my husband's grandfather, as it turned out, wasn't even on an official train. He was from Missouri with his siblings, but there were children sent on trains all over the United States at that period.
And it's so interesting when you think of possibly 200,000 children being taken from the East Coast to other parts of the country on a train in many ways by themselves. Was it a kind of shame or was it their kind of trauma? They just did not want to visit or revisit this time of their life?
There are actually a lot of factors. And by the way, they now say 250,000 children. Mm-hmm. The numbers are hard to quantify because terrible records were kept. In fact, part of the point was that they wanted these children, and this is also part of why we don't know more about it, they wanted the children to start over. They told them, the chaperones and the nuns who put them on the trains and escorted them across the country said, your parents are not your parents. Your past is not your past. Your life begins the moment you're chosen. Siblings were separated. Children, as you mentioned, were sent in a labor program. So there was a great stigma about it. These children looked and sounded and acted quite different from the children in these small conservative Midwestern communities, often Scandinavian communities. And, you know, we also can't discount the fact that there was no such thing as therapy at that time.
Sure.
For these children. And they were all severely traumatized in one way or another. As one train rider said to me, each one of us who rode on a train had been through some tremendous trauma. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been there. The trains were our last resort.
Well, in fact, Neve, the girl in your story of fire, her family comes from Ireland to New York City, and there's a fire, and in a sense sort of loses her family at that time.
Yeah.
And is put on a train. And one wonders, were all these children actually orphans? Were they largely immigrant children coming to big cities like New York?
Such a good question. Many of them were immigrants. When the trains began in 1854, there were 30,000 children living on the streets of New York City,
wow,
if you can imagine.
Wow.
So the train riders were, 30% of them, they figure, were orphaned. The rest were abandoned. They were runaways. They were taken out of homes. And they were actually plucked off the streets by the police. Parents would tell their children, don't go out after 6 o'clock because you might get put in a paddy wagon and put on an orphan train.
So they were seen as, what, vagrants or troublemakers or just sort of riffraff that would cause problems for the city?
They were. There were no social programs. There was no welfare. There was no foster care. Children were property. Poor children, you know, pure and simple, were labor. But these children were dying in great numbers. They were going to prison. They were becoming prostitutes, joining gangs. They were getting run over, dying of exposure. Mm. They were considered a scourge. They called them street Arabs, vagrants.
Street Arabs?
Yes, that's what they called them. I know. So interesting. There's so many racial interesting things in all of this. And by the way, the Irish were particularly vulnerable to problems when they came to this country, having survived the Great Famine, if they did, and stumbled onto a boat and come across, only to face tremendous discrimination in this country as well. I always say when I talk about the book that every new immigrant group to this country goes through a hazing process. And we tend to forget that often the people who are complaining about immigrants coming in now are themselves the product of immigrants who've come through and faced difficulty. So it's, I think, part of what I really enjoyed doing this book was understanding and getting to learn about how different immigrant groups assimilated when they came over. And one last thing I also want to say, which
sure,
is people often ask why children would be taken out of homes. If the problem was that they were homeless and there were way too many of them, why would you even take children out of homes? I didn't know until I began researching this book that in the mid to late 19th century, poverty was considered to be an inherited affliction. So if parents went to poor houses, or if parents were particularly poor themselves, children were often taken away from them so that they wouldn't continue to be infected, so they wouldn't inherit this affliction that was passed from one generation to the next, which I just find fascinating.
Poverty is a kind of communicable disease.
Disease. It was a communicable disease, it was believed to be. And so, again, that's one of the reasons that train riders faced such stigma and trauma when they got to the Midwest. They were treated with great suspicion by a number of people. And so even the people who took them in often lied about where they'd gotten these children. They would say they'd gotten them from, like, a poor neighbor who had run into difficulties or a relative far away. They often didn't admit they'd gotten them from the orphan trains because there was such a stigma about that.
And I do want to get more to your novel, but another little piece of history, which I guess makes all this possible, is the laying of the railroad tracks in this growing country. And I guess even the Midwest, looking for people to live there, work there.
Oh, my goodness. The whole story of the railroads in our country is fascinating, and how they expanded and where and how they populated those unpopulated areas. What I found in my research was that the children, their travel was often subsidized by the train companies, who wanted to get bodies out to these rural areas where few people lived. And they were gambling on the idea that when these children got to the Midwest, they would not return to New York and to the East Coast. And in fact, they could not have been more right. Not only did most children never return to the East Coast, most of them never even left the small communities that they were put into, much less the states they went into. One train rider was explaining to me that she said, "We had been through so much turmoil, I just wanted to stay put." And so that's what most of them did.
You include in your novel, a wanted or an advertisement, homes for orphan children. A company of homeless children from the East will arrive at Milwaukee Road Depot Friday, October 18th. Distribution will take place at 10 a.m. These children are of various ages and both sexes, having been thrown friendless upon the world.
Isn't that just astounding?
Is that almost word for word from an ad that you might have seen in your research?
It is word for word. And when I give my presentation, I do a slideshow with all these incredible slides of indenture certificates and photographs and these kinds of things. And I have the actual poster that I quoted from. That is actually what they said, that they, having been thrown friendless upon the world. And they also, that same poster goes on to say that these children are come from somewhat respectable families, so that they're therefore desirable children and worthy of good homes.
Of course, this is before child labor laws. I mean, are we talking slavery here? Are we talking indentured servitude? And many of these children working on farms, working in houses.
Yeah, they were actually called indentured servants, or they were contracted. There were two ways of doing it. They were indentured to the age of 18 or 21. So imagine being a homeless kid from the streets of New York, and by the way, the most desirable ones, of course, as you might imagine, boys from 9 to 14 years old who could be pure labor on the farms. Maybe you belong to a gang. Maybe you haven't had a home for a while. Maybe you've just been roaming the streets. And suddenly you are essentially slave labor until the age of 21, and you have no choice about it. Not only that, there was no screening process. So there was almost no oversight. So, yes, there are many parallels. And, in fact, the National Orphan Train Complex says that in many instances these children took the place of slaves. And they even went into slaveholding states. I have a map that shows how far these children went all over the United States. And they did in some instances. Slavery was just ending, replaced slaves.
And we're about a minute before our break here. And what would girls end up doing if boys were doing the kind of farm labor, girls tending to house chores, things like that?
Girls were domestics. They cooked, they cleaned, they sewed, and they took care of children. And by the way, girls were the least wanted. They were considered fallen women, a threat to the female of the household. And unlike boys who could eat and even sleep in the barn, girls had to be socialized and live in the house. So they were the last chosen often.
And fallen woman, maybe if she's 10 years old, still considered a fallen woman?
Yeah, I mean, the idea, the concept of childhood as we know it did not really exist. It's interesting. And God knows the things that these orphan train riders went through. You can imagine the spectrum of things that they ended up going through. I didn't write about, well, we can talk about that in the next segment, but I didn't write about some of the worst examples I came across, or even perhaps the most wonderful ones. I wanted to show a representative picture.
And that's Christina Baker Klein. We're talking about her novel, Orphan Train. And again, it was chosen for this year's One Book, One Philadelphia by the Free Library of Philadelphia. Taking a very short break, we'll get back to our conversation. And after the break, I'd love to have our guest read a section from her novel. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Again, I'm talking with Christina Baker Klein about her novel Orphan Train, again, selected by One Book, One Philadelphia by the Free Library of Philadelphia for this year. In fact, you can go to freelibrary.org, go to the One Philadelphia One Book icon, and you can find out about all sorts of events here in the city. The final event is March 19th at the Free Library. And of course, you can always join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Christina, I would like to have you read a section from the from your novel, but first tell us about Neve, and she is your main character, if I can put it that way.
Right. Neve is a young girl who has whose family has emigrated from the west coast of Ireland, from Galway area, a little village called Kinvara, which, by the way, I chose because Kinvara sent the largest number of immigrants from Ireland to our country at the time period that I was writing about. And I went to Kinvara and had an amazing time there, going through the records and seeing how and why people had left, because it's a beautiful place. It's hard to imagine why anyone would leave, but now. By the way, the Titanic left 5 miles from there.
Oh, really?
So it was a place of many leavings. So her family comes through Ellis Island and can't get a foothold. They can't make it work. And fire propelled them out of their tenement, meaning there was a terrible fire, the cause of which is never quite explained. And again, in my research, this was common. There were many tenement fires. Tenements were often far from firehouses. There was often no ready source of water. There were no telephones. There are lots of reasons that fires were rampant and spread. And also, many people had cottage industries in their apartments and lots of people in there and paper. So it was easy for that to happen. But so she ends up on a train, and she has red hair, by the way, which was not a good thing. Being Irish was bad enough. Being a girl, not so great either. But having red hair, with the chaperones were concerned that she might not get chosen. She is chosen because she's going to now be a seamstress and work in someone's home. But when the stock market crashes, that falls apart. And so you sort of move along the novel with this character as she goes through her journey of going into several homes that are quite different from each other and trying to find a foothold in a world that she doesn't understand and has never experienced before without her family. And she's alone and she's 9 years old.
Well, I'd love to have you read this section from the book.
Okay, terrific. I am with a group of 20 children, all ages. We're scrubbed and in our donated clothes, the girls in dresses with white pinafores and thick stockings, the boys in knickers that button below the knee, white dress shirts, neckties, thick wool suit coats. It's an unseasonably warm October day, Indian summer, Mrs. Scatcherd calls it, and we are sweltering on the platform. My hair is damp against my neck, the pinafore stiff and uncomfortable. In one hand, I clutch a small brown suitcase that, excepting the cross, contains everything I have in the world, all newly acquired. A Bible, 2 sets of clothes, a hat, a black coat several sizes too small, a pair of shoes. Inside the coat is my name, embroidered by a volunteer at the Children's Aid Society, Neve Power. Yes, N-I-A-M-H, pronounced Neve, a common enough name in County Galway and not so unusual in the Irish tenements in New York, but certainly not acceptable anywhere the train might take me. The lady who sewed those letters several days ago tisked over the task. I hope you aren't attached to that name, young miss, because I can promise, if you're lucky enough to be chosen, your new parents will change it in a second. My Neve, my da used to call me, but I'm not so attached to the name. I know it's hard to pronounce, foreign, unlovely, to those who don't understand, a peculiar jumble of unmatched consonants. No one feels sorry for me because I've lost my family. Each of us has a sad tale. We wouldn't be here otherwise. The general feeling is that it's best not to talk about the past, that the quickest relief will come in forgetting. The Children's Aid Society treats us as if we were born the moment we were brought in, that like moths breaking out of their cocoons, we've left our old lives behind, and God willing, will soon launch ourselves into new ones. Mrs. Scatcherd and Mr. Curran, a milquetoast with a brown mustache, line us up by height, tallest to shortest, which generally means oldest to youngest, with the babies in the arms of the children over 8. Mrs. Scatcherd pushes a baby into my arms before I can object, an olive-skinned, cross-eyed 14-month-old named Carmine, who, I can already predict, will soon answer to another name. He clings to me like a terrified kitten. Brown suitcase in one hand, the other holding Carmine secure, I navigate the high steps into the train unsteadily before Mr. Curran scurries over to take my bag. Use some common sense, girl, he scolds. If you fall, you'll crack your skulls, and then we'll have to leave the both of you behind.
Mm. That's Christina Baker Klein reading from her novel, Orphan Train. this idea of changing people's names, and this happens quite a bit in this novel, and I know it's also happened with immigrant families coming to Ellis Island, where oftentimes the officials at the island would change someone's last name, you know, to make it more Americanized. But it's such a profound thing to do to someone, especially to a child.
It is, and, you know, the closest thing to it, I guess, is taking in a rescue pet and naming it something else, which people do all the time.
Yes.
I think that, you know, these immigrant children were looked at with suspicion and also as not 100% human in some ways, not always. You know, many people who took in the children, especially the babies, treated them kindly and with compassion. But for many people, they were labor, and they were a little bit less than human in the way that slaves were considered a little bit less than human.
But it does seem, I mean, she is, Neve, she is a strong and resilient young woman. Then we know her as an older woman, an elderly woman. And I know you've interviewed some of these grown-up orphans, if I can call them that, survivors, I guess, of the orphan.
They call themselves train riders.
Train riders. I mean, do you see a kind of resilience among them? And I know you interviewed a number of them for the book.
Yes, I had a wonderful experience, actually. I was racing to an event that I was doing with a lot of people, and this man buttonholed me on my way in, and I was like, God, I have to go in. And he said, no, I have to talk to you. He was a train rider, and he was thrust at me an article about him. After his daughter read my novel, she started to put things together. And it turns out he and his brother had been in the foundling hospital together, were separated, lost from each other. And anyway, long story short, his brother was tracked down. And so the Lions Club, which they both belonged to, not knowing each other for their whole lives and now in their 90s, did a cover story about them in their magazine or whatever. And so he had the magazine. And anyway, I brought him up on stage and the two of us did the whole thing together. Yeah. And at the end, he said, I believe that the people who survived and thrived, these orphan trains, were had a certain kind of resilience. And, you know, those of us who came through have created this whole strong strain in American culture. He was really proud of his experience and proud of what he had kind of overcome and how well he had ended up doing. And so I was struck by that. I do think that these train riders ultimately came past shame, a lot of them because their descendants were so excited about it, so passionate about trying to find out what had happened to them. You know, the birth certificates of these people were altered, destroyed, and locked up by the organizations. They really didn't want them to trace back where they had come to where they had come from. So it's difficult for their descendants to find out what happened in many cases. But they're trying, and so the reunions are now filled with hundreds of descendants with three-ring binders looking for information.
Neve lives with a couple of different families, including the Grote family. And, you know, at one point, the husband basically sexually assaults her while she's sleeping in a part of the house. How common was that, especially for girls?
We don't have figures, but anecdotally, I think it's considering the power imbalance, the fact that they were not related by blood to these families, and the fact that they were adolescent girls came in a subservient position where they were the household help. They were vulnerable in all kinds of ways. Boys were vulnerable to being beaten, obviously, and mistreated in all kinds of ways, as were girls. It was what I tried to show with the Grotes. Again, there were some really terrible stories that I heard that he did not end up actually succeeding in his task in the book, in the novel.
He didn't.
In fact, he did. It's a disturbing scene, I think. Very. Yesterday, I did a presentation at a middle school where the whole middle school read it, including the seventh graders. And I had a long conversation with them about that scene. A letter was sent home to the parents explaining that scene was in the book. It, as I said, it does end without it ends well for her, pretty much. But nonetheless, I wanted to show that essentially in that situation, these children were at the mercy of the people who took them in, and that was a very vulnerable and difficult position to be in. And even with the kindest families, as I showed with the Nielsens, there was often a two-tiered family system where the children in a household might be treated by blood might be treated differently than the train riders. So it was hard for these children. It was hard to assimilate. It was hard to come through. Some of them thrived. Many of them thrived, actually. Many of them thrived. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that.
Something about, I mean, perhaps luck, and maybe something about their character, or even their personality. Let me just read a little section here, though. This is Neve saying, "I feel myself retreating to someplace deep inside. It's a pitiful kind of childhood to know that no one loves you or is taking care of you, to always be on the outside looking in. I feel a decade older than my years. I know too much. I've seen people at their worst, at their most desperate and selfish, and this knowledge makes me wary. So I am learning to pretend, to smile and nod, to display empathy I do not feel. I'm learning to pass, to look like everyone else, even though I feel broken inside." I mean, were you interested as a writer to sort of trying to understand how someone processes and deals with trauma? I mean, really, in many ways, this is trauma.
Yeah, that was actually my initial sort of framework or interest in the story was about the legacy of trauma and how people come through to the other side. Catherine Harrison is a wonderful writer, and she's written a lot about trauma. And she says that when you undergo a tremendous trauma, you step into a kind of parallel world where you have to look. You, on the outside, no one really knows, but what you're experiencing inside is so disconnected from how you express yourself that it's hard to reconcile. And you step into a kind of a different world that you can't explain readily. I've had some experiences of trauma in my own life, but I think maybe the most dramatic recently is a few years ago. I went through cancer treatment, and for a long time when I had hair, people didn't know who knew me only, you know, in passing, I guess. And there was so much that I didn't look the way I felt or the way I or even all the things that I was sort of undergoing at the time were not part of the way I presented myself. And I felt very fractured. And I think that's maybe the word for these children. Mm-hmm. A lot of them felt fractured, and they had to learn to survive the way they did. They really pushed it down. And so that's one reason we don't know a lot about these trains. And because these children kept it quiet for many, many years, really until their descendants began asking. But I will also say that the history of our country is not the history of the poor and the dispossessed. And so few people were writing about the orphan trains at the time.
I'm curious, just thinking about that passage and what you also said about yourself as you were going through cancer treatment. So did you, in a sense, because maybe you didn't look like you were dealing with cancer, that you were, in a sense, passing, to use
yes.
one of the words you had in that section
yes.
that I just read?
Yeah,
you're passing
exactly
as a healthy person or a non-cancer person?
I was passing as a healthy person. And also, all the stuff was too complicated to even – you wouldn't dump that on someone who you're making small talk with on the street. You kind of can't convey and shouldn't convey in everyday conversation the magnitude of your experience at the moment. So it's cognitive dissonance that you're living with constantly when you're undergoing something very intense and everyone else that you encounter doesn't really – know that or see it.
How's your health today?
I'm, knock on wood, doing well.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. There's another character, if I can say, in the story. This is Molly Eyre. She's a teenager. She is living in the same town as Vivian in Maine. And she is, in a sense, aging out of the foster care system. So she's almost ready to graduate high school. Did you see some parallels between Molly's story and Vivian's story?
There are obvious parallels between their stories. This is going to sound incredibly naive, but I didn't realize quite how many until I had finished a draft. I had, at the time I was writing the book, I had two teenagers, 16 and 17, exactly the ages of Molly, and I had teenagers trooping through my house, and I thought, this is perfect. I understand the patois, the language, this beast in its natural habitat. And there was a friend of my oldest son who was sort of a model for Molly. But also, I grew up in Bangor, Maine, 10 miles from Indian Island, and there were Native children in my community, and I had never written about it before, and about the Penobscots explicitly. And also my mother was very involved in Native American rights in Maine. She was in the Maine State Legislature, and she passed all this legislation with this wonderful Wabanaki elder, the only Indian elected legislator in the state of Maine, Donna Loring. To protect Indian rights in all these ways. And so she was very involved in that, and that was another aspect of the Molly story.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And our guest is Christina Baker Klein, and we've been talking about her novel, Orphan Train, and it is the selection this year. Philadelphia Free Library of Philadelphia chose this novel for its One Book, One Philadelphia selection this year. And we asked Christina Baker Klein to join us on Radio Time to talk about the book and some of the making and some of the history that goes into the book as well. You can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with novelist Christina Baker Klein. And again, to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You mentioned the fact that you grew up in Bangor, Maine. I read that you were a babysitter for Stephen King and his wife. Is that true?
Yeah, my parents were professors at the University of Maine, and they knew the Kings. And I babysat for him a few times. Owen and Joe, his sons, who were wonderful. Owen, in particular, is a friend of mine now. He was a little monster at the moment at that time. but they lived, you know, they were, of course, the huge celebrities in Maine and in my town. But there was something, I think, about having Stephen King in my universe as a kid growing up that gave me a kind of picture of possibility that one could actually become a writer. And he always said, I happen to be lucky to have a marketable obsession. That was what he was saying.
Writing being yeah. That marketable obsession?
Exactly. Writing being that marketable obsession. And their house has this sort of amazing black fence, which is composed of snakes and spiders, and it's very gothic. It's perfect, but it was maybe he was a role model in a way for me.
Were you a good babysitter?
You know, I was a good babysitter. I was the oldest of four girls, and I took care of my younger sisters when my mother went back to work. I also did pretty much all the cooking from the age of about 11 or 12 on in our household. In some ways, the tasks that I ascribed to my Orphan Train character, Neve, were tasks that I myself did in my own home when I was growing up.
Did you feel like an orphan in your own home?
I didn't feel like an orphan, but I did feel a little bit like an indentured servant sometimes.
Having to take care of everybody. You know what's so interesting is I was reading somewhere that something like 20 or so book clubs have chosen Orphan Train as their selected reading, and that's, of course, what the Free Library of Philadelphia did with this novel. Why do you think that is?
You mean 20 book clubs
across the country? No, across the country. This seems to be a popular...
I'm sorry to say this, but I think it's been thousands of book clubs.
I'm sorry to say that as well. No.
No, I don't mean to brag.
No,
but,
no problem.
But actually, I think what's fascinating is that it's all these community reads and campus reads. Well, first of all, I will say book clubs have been a huge part of the book's success, I guess.
Is that right?
From the very beginning, book clubs have been passionate readers. And in fact, last night I did an event in Connecticut, and there were a number of entire book clubs. And there, lately at my events, there are often like 5 or 10 entire book clubs there, which is an interesting thing for a whole book club to come to an event, an author event. I love that. So book clubs, I think, are a growing and interesting aspect of the American reading experience at the moment. I think book clubs are a lot of them are passionate readers. They buy books. They really discuss them. They're serious about them all over the country. I've been traveling pretty constantly since the novel came out, and it's fascinating to see that.
But it's also taking a solitary experience. You know, most people read books by themselves and making it a communal one.
That's right. But I will say, people, I think, back in the day used to talk about books because they were the thing, they were an entertainment, not in perhaps this organized way, but they were part of a cultural conversation. And book clubs are doing that. They're a place that people who are perhaps out, I'm meeting with people all over the country in Wisconsin and Minnesota and Oregon State, who are in fairly isolated communities, perhaps, who, because of book clubs, have a community they can just talk about ideas with.
But what's so interesting, and not to belabor your other books that didn't do quite as well as this one, but what do you think it was about? Is it the story and the fact that it's a bit about some American history as well that has resonated with readers?
Yeah, I mean, my last most successful book sold around 30,000 copies, I think, which, by the way, I thought was great. I would have been happy to keep selling that way. And that's a respectable career. And that was honestly what I aspired to, was just to write books and have a nice career writing books. And I have no doubt that my next book will be a miserable failure by the standards of this 2 million copies.
Is that what it is, 2 million copies?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I think that several things. I think no one had any idea this would happen. My publisher didn't know at all for a while, and then it just sort of got this momentum. And then I think something happens at a certain point where there's a tipping point and it just becomes a phenomenon, and that's sort of what happened here. It tipped over into a wide readership, and then people heard that people were reading it and that all that. I will say that obviously this story, this untold, it has been told, but most people haven't heard about it, story of the orphan trains, the story that's been hidden in plain sight, is one that a lot of people want to know about and are eager to hear about. And that maybe the two generations, the 91-year-old woman and the 17-year-old girl, give it a sort of broad range. I do remember, however, being in a group in a meeting with my publisher, where one of the marketing people said, "You know, you have this cranky old lady and this disaffected goth teenager. We're not really hitting your demographic here."
Apparently, you are.
Well, maybe a whole different,
yeah,
obviously,
exactly.
Demographic, right? So that was funny.
Let me get Mike from Reading to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
A few years ago, there was an article in Smithsonian Magazine about the orphan trains, and I was just kind of curious if she had was aware of that article or had used any of that material as part of her research.
Mike,
yeah, of course.
For the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much. I read everything I could get my hands on about the orphan trains. I did read that article. And when I say this story has been hidden in plain sight, in those 7 years where I wasn't writing the book, but I was percolating in my mind, thinking about it and writing other novels, I had a Google alert, and there were all these articles. There were New York Times articles, Washington Post articles. There may even have been a Philadelphia Inquirer article about some aspect of an orphan train reunion or some reparations. There were these bits and pieces that were in the press. Stephen O'Connor has written a tremendously wonderful history of the orphan trains. The PBS did a documentary. There's even an American Girl doll with an orphan train rider friend.
No, so, really?
Yes. And Little House in the Prairie had an orphan train rider episode where there was an orphan train rider. The New York Historical Society in their Children's Museum has a part of the exhibit that is about the orphan train riders. So there are all these kind of bits that you can find in American culture, references to them.
I'm waiting for the movie to come out of Hollywood, don't you think?
It's time for that? Well, it has been optioned. It has been optioned, but we don't know. Who knows? I'm not holding my breath. It's a long process, you know.
We're talking about book clubs. We have an email from Peg. She says, my hometown of Bristol, Connecticut, had book clubs named after the Greek muses in the 40s and 50s. My mother was in Calliope.
Just, oh, how wonderful.
Yeah,
that's lovely.
How nice is that? So are you working on another book?
I am working on another book that actually has a tie to Pennsylvania. The novel I'm working on now is inspired by a painting, Christina's World by Andrew Wyeth.
Of course. Very famous
painting.
Which
is the woman. Yes, it is. A woman in a pink dress sitting in a field looking at a gray house in the distance. Very odd, sort of forbidding, strange painting that's at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And Wyeth, as you know, lived in Pennsylvania and also in Maine, Cushing, Maine, which is where that story takes place. Christina Olson was a real person, and her own personal history is fascinating, and I'm having a blast writing it, actually.
Seems like Maine figures pretty strongly in some of your writing.
It does, and in Orphan Train, there's a little town called Spruce Harbor, which I made up, which is on Mount, I call it Mount Desert Island, but some locals say Desert.
Mount Desert Island.
Island, yes. And it's on the quiet side of the island between or around Southwest Harbor and Bass Harbor. I have a house in Southwest Harbor, and I didn't want a real place because I wanted to be able to change some details and have Main Street where I wanted it to be. I've used Spruce Harbor in a number of novels, and I will continue to do so.
You also have young woman, Molly Eyre, goes to the Mount Desert Island High School. Is there such a high school?
There sure is. It's a wonderful high school. And my three boys went to this tremendously spectacular arts camp, day camp there called the Summer Festival for the Arts. And I am convinced my one son is a music major in college, and I know it's because of that experience at Mount Desert Island High School.
Well, as you said, Stephen King said you had an obsession. I mean, have you always wanted to write? Even as a little girl?
I always wrote. And I never presumed or perhaps had the confidence to believe that I would be able to necessarily make a living at it. What I have always told my students when I teach, I've taught a lot of college, is that I think the answer for how this all happened is that I tended to follow the yes when people said no, which was often. I would usually turn around and listen to the person, maybe the only person, who was encouraging me and go in that direction. But the other thing, and the thing that I'm particularly aware of as I have two boys in college at the moment, is that I never thought I would only make a living as a writer, and so I always had a skill. I've edited my whole life. I've done freelance editing in all kinds of ways, and I've also taught. I've always taught. So I dreamed and hoped that I would be a novelist, and I've written all these novels, but I haven't always made a living at being a novelist. So I think you can, and I tell my son, who's a music major, who is double majoring in poli sci, I say, you can be a musician, but just know that you also need to think about how to earn a living, perhaps, too.
You talked about turning no's into yeses, and I having done improv many years ago, one of the sort of games you play is a kind of yes and, idea is that you don't say no to things, you add on to them. You see possibilities in them. Sounds like you have that mindset.
Ah, God, you have to. If you're going to be any kind of artist, I think, you have to. Otherwise, you would curl up in a ball. It's such a hard world, all of this. And I get, you know, letters every day from people who are trying to break in, trying to get published. It's brutal. It's brutal. And ultimately, I think being open. And today, I think one of the exciting things is there are a lot of ways to publish. There are a lot of ways to do this. And the world is changing. And I have children that age, and it's exciting to watch.
Indeed, it is. As you mentioned, the fact that this novel we've been talking about, Orphan Train, sold 2 million copies, and then you've got this next one in the works, you're sort of anticipating that it's not going to be, you know, the sort of smashing success that the one we've been talking about.
So just as an example of how blasé I have become, the New York Times list comes out on Wednesdays. My editor calls every Wednesday, which is so lovely. And so for the past, like, I don't know, 70 weeks, I've been in the top five. Yesterday I was number six, and it was terrible news that I'm like, really? That's so silly. I mean, it's so ridiculous. This is ridiculous. And we laugh because it's not real. It's not going to last, obviously, but also it will never happen again. It's just, I was saying to her, you call on Wednesdays and I just expect you're going to call and we know this is going to end, number one. And number two, my next book is destined to be a disappointment no matter what. Every single thing that happened with this book was a surprise and a wonderful surprise. And it's terrible to think that one might become accustomed to it or jaded. So my expectations are purely that, you know, I think the publisher's quite happy with this book. I don't think I owe them a thing. And I think that we'll just go back to the way things were and that will be fine.
That seems kind of fine as well. I'm curious about, since this was chosen in Philadelphia, whether you got any kind of different reactions to the novel from the Philadelphia-based readers?
Well, I'm just heading into that. I've done several events in Philly, but I'm spending a week there in March, so I'm sure I'll be getting lots of feedback of all kinds. I've done a lot of community reads. This is the biggest one, but I did a pretty giant one in Sarasota a couple of weeks ago. I think I had like 1,700 people at the event, at the big final event. And it's been chosen by about 30 communities for community reads. So I'm getting accustomed to this, to getting many, many responses to the novel of all kinds and questions I've never even heard before, which is quite amazing because I've been talking about this silly book for a year and a half. I don't mean the book is silly. I just mean I'm silly talking about it so often and so much. It's been such a joy to get a variety of responses from people. Like, for example, here, I'll tell you one.
Sure, go ahead.
Just because it was critical and funny. Last night at this big event, a man stood up and I mentioned the Irish potato famine and he was angry that I used that terminology, that it's not a potato famine. I do understand that it's a famine and that it wasn't caused by the potato. You know, I do, but it's a shorthand. And so, yes, he's a scholar of that People have many reactions to many different aspects of the book, mostly positive, I must say, or at least to me. But I welcome conversation about it, and I'm learning too, and I'm learning a lot about many different aspects of this story that I didn't even know when I finished the book.
Well, Christina Baker Klein, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And the book is called Orphan Train. And again, the selection by the Free Library of Philadelphia for their One Book, One Philadelphia. Go to freelibrary.org and you can go to their One Book, One Philadelphia icon for more information. The final event in the city is on March 19th. And you can also go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow and Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. Thank you so much for joining us.